Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan Political Podcast. The MERS team is joined by Bridge Detroit journalist Malachi Barrett and Adolph Mongo, a Detroit political commentator, to discuss how Detroit voters are feeling about the 2024 election cycle. They zoom in on the Democratic rivalry between U.S. Rep. Shri Tanadar and challenger Adam Hollier in the 13th Congressional District, as well as how Detroiters are reacting to the U.S. Senate and presidential races. Additionally, State House Majority Floor Leader Abraham Ayash, a Hamtramck Democrat, explains his decision to not pursue re-election as a state representative. He also illustrates his experiences while attending several university protests for a ceasefire in the Middle East. Furthermore, MERS speaks with State Senator Thomas Albert, a Lowell Republican and past House Appropriations Chair. He describes his top three concerns with the developing state budget. Now, here's MERS podcast host Samantha Schreiber, editor Kyle Malin, and joining on the second segment, MERS House reporter Danielle James.
Thank you so much, Mark Bayshore, for warming up today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. For this morning's roundtable discussion, we are going to be zooming in on the city of Detroit and how the 2024 election cycle is unfolding in Michigan's most populous city, as well as one of the country's major Black majority municipalities. Joining us to dive into the present-day political dynamics of Detroit, we are going to be joined a little bit later by Adolph Mongo, a Detroit podcaster and political commentator. Like I said, he will be hopping on a little bit later. He is currently going through airport security right now. So listeners, stay tuned. Adolph will be hopping on fairly soon. And additionally, who is on the call with us right now is journalist Malachi Barrett, a Detroit local government and community issues reporter for Bridge Detroit. Hey, Malachi, how are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on, Sam.
No, well, thank you so much for joining us. So let's just kick off our conversation with the 13th Congressional District, which is based in Detroit, as well as some of the downriver communities. And the expected Democratic primary race between incumbent U.S. Representative Shri Tanadar and second-time congressional candidate Adam Hollier, the past state senator, also expected to be in that Democratic primary in August, is Wayne County criminal defense attorney Shakira Lynn Hawkins and Detroit City Council member Mary Waters. Adam Hollier's campaign is currently in some hot water as of May 3rd, when his petition signatures to appear on the primary ballot were formally challenged by Tanadar's campaign for claims of possible forgery. More than 9 petition pages reportedly feature dozens of signatures that appear to be from the same person, displaying notable similarities in handwriting. So my question for you, Malachi, is based off what you have seen in the city of Detroit from a reporter's perspective, do you think Adam Hollier's campaign has been functional enough to still make it on the ballot, even with these flawed signatures?
Yeah, I think this is a pretty significant question mark, potentially disastrous even for a candidate who Democrats were really hoping could restore Detroit's Black representation in Congress, which was lost for the first time in nearly 70 years when Tanadar kind of emerged from a pretty crowded primary and became the district representative just 2 years ago. And, you know, I think this is a process that we're still in the early stages of. Hollier's campaign has until Tuesday to submit formal response to Representative Tanadar's challenge. The Wayne County clerk is going to investigate that and decide whether the petitions are valid. Hollier also has the chance to appeal after that. But what's significant about this is, you know, Tanadar challenged basically half of the signatures that Hollier's campaign had submitted. He needs 1,000 to get on the ballot. He has about 1,500 that were submitted, and Tanadar challenged a little under 800 of them. And in addition to some of the allegations of forgeries and duplicate signatures that were collected by one person in particular, this Ground Mine Strategies organization, there's a number that are challenged because they are allegedly outside of the district or people who are not registered as voters or have the wrong address. So I think it's a big question how many of those can get kind of worked out. There's a process by which to resolve some of the signature issues. And then some of them, you know, might be thrown out altogether. You know, Hollier, this campaign seemed a little bit different compared to his challenge against Tanadar last time around. because they appeared more organized. They had a coalition of Wayne County leaders that came out early behind Ollier. He's got dozens of endorsements from Democratic officials and the Congressional Black Caucus. He had really seemed to be putting together, you know, a coalition from that end. So, you know, Michigan is not a stranger to these kinds of candidate signature issues. I think we all remember the gubernatorial race where the top of the ticket was basically knocked out because they had worked with some companies that cut corners, I think it's fair to say. And I don't know. I mean, is that the same thing that happened here? Is this an issue of the campaign? Can you blame, you know, the candidate for this? I think you can kind of blame them for maybe not checking these before turning them in. But it really just puts his eligibility into question after getting a lot of important endorsements behind him and having this real kind of more organized attempt to restore Black representation.
No, when I came across last week's story, my initial thought was, oh my goodness, is this a repeat of what we saw in 2022, where numerous Republican gubernatorial candidates were disqualified from the ballot because they were working with the same companies that are now still amid their prelim trials for essentially sitting in circles and just doing a lot of signature fraud? What are your thoughts on this? Is this a repeat of 2022, or is this something completely new entirely?
Well, this is a different firm from my understanding than the firms that were involved last time around. So I'm wondering if this kind of speaks to kind of broader issues with the signature gathering process by which candidates basically rely on firms to hire people who go out to Eastern Market in Detroit and down by Hart Plaza and kind of go through downtown and various parts of the city to collect signatures from people. I think there have been concerns raised in the past about the professionalism of some of the people that are collecting signatures and whether they fully understand the rules of our election process and what's going on, or if they're even misleading people about what they're gathering signatures for. I don't know much about Groundmine Strategies, this company. They have a website that's up online, but the staff member who was accused of collecting a lot of these potentially fraudulent signatures, his staff page was pulled off the website. So yeah, I mean, I think it kind of speaks to some larger question marks around how candidates collect signatures. And it's just going to be really interesting to see what comes out of this, because the other two candidates who were in this race, Mary Waters, who's a Detroit City Council member, and as you mentioned, you know, Shakira Hawkins, a criminal defense attorney, they're very low level candidates, in my, you know, opinion. They don't have a lot of name recognition. Mary Waters has run for a lot of things. She's an effective city council member, but has run for higher level positions and not really had much success in the past. So you kind of wonder if this issue kind of gets in the way of Ollier being on the ballot, you know, similar to how strong challengers to Governor Whitmer were knocked out of the ballot. Does that kind of open the way for candidate to just kind of skate to reelection and, you know, get through this primary relatively unscathed?
Looks like Adolf has joined us now. And Adolf, I appreciate you being on the podcast here. What was your reaction to the news that it looks like Adam Ollier does not have the signatures needed to make the ballot?
Unbelievable. Here's a guy that he's been a state senator, state representative, and this is politics 101. Get the signatures. Make sure you got enough to, you know, withstand a challenge. That's the way the game is played.
And what do you think the chances are? And Malachi, you could answer this too, but starting with you, Adolf, what are the chances that Adam could put together a write-in campaign similar to what Mike Duggan did his first time running for mayor and actually be successful with it?
Well, Mike Duggan was a brand in Wayne County. He knew Detroit. He had operatives in Detroit. I'm telling you, Adam had a problem the first time he ran for Congress. A lot of people couldn't even pronounce his name. Are they going to be able to write it in? Do we have enough money to mount a write-in campaign? And it's been done before. We look at the senator from Alaska, and that's a statewide write-in campaign. She ran as an independent and won, but you got to have a lot of money, and you got to have a hell of an organization. And for him to turn in 1,500 signatures, that means somebody dropped the ball and they wasn't looking at the most important thing of this election. Get on the ballot first.
And let's not talk about this petition signature headline for a moment, but if we just think about Adam versus Shree in general, I mean, what were some dynamics at play in 2022 that are no longer taking place in 2024? For example, I mean, what are some things that helped Shree in 2022 that are no longer available to him this time around as he pursues re-election?
You had Coleman Young, who has lots of support in the community. You had John Conyers III, because of his father's long reputation as a congressperson. You had a lot of other people. It diluted the vote. Now, in this race, you still got Mary Waters, who's well-known, sitting on the city council. So, you know what? Shree still had the upper hand. He's an incumbent, and this is a presidential election. People go with what they know.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, echoing on that, Tanner really had the advantage last time of running in a group of nine. And you know, I think that was the chief concern this time around, was that Democrats, you know, Black Democrats in particular, who wanted to restore that representation, had to kind of coalesce behind one candidate. Tanner has a record to defend now. He has talked about bringing money back into the district, but his constituent services has been called into question by former staff members and colleagues. This, you know, one of the main criticisms that Ollier's had is that Shree's kind of not been present or not been responsive to issues in the district. You know, he has really strong name recognition, though. I think it's hard to kind of underplay how present Tanner was, how much he knocked on doors last time around, and he's been out in the community since. I think one major shift of this is like a larger shift that's affecting a lot of elections this year. And in that, you know, Tanner has the support of AIPAC now, which was a top funder of OEA in the last election. And Tanner was actually kind of a rare example nationally of beating a candidate who was preferred by, you know, the pro-Israeli lobbying firm. And Tanner has kind of reversed his position. He's now a staunch defender of Israel's military actions. You know, he has come out pretty strongly in terms of the rhetoric of defending Israel's action. He said that Hamas needs to be eliminated and there is going to be civilian casualties that come along with that. So he's been facing, a lot of opposition from pro-Palestine supporters in the district in Wayne County. He actually texted me this morning because one of his community centers on the west side of Detroit was apparently vandalized last night. But, you know, Tanner was on the other side of this issue in the last election. And it seems like by evolving his stance, I guess we could say, he's kind of neutralized a potential source of campaign cash that would have flown to his opponent.
Also, you know, really the Gaza war in his district is not in the top five that people are thinking about. It's probably in the top 10, but crime and schools and other stuff. He's in one of the poorest districts in the U.S. So he has to walk a fine line. If he was over in the 12th district, then I think he would have some issues. But I think in this district, you know what? It's great. That extra money from AIPAC is coming through. It's just icing on the cake. That's all.
Adolph, Malachi talked a little earlier about Mary Waters and the fact that she doesn't appear to be running a serious congressional campaign. What do you see from her? And do you think she's got a shot to be successful in the primary?
She's a spoiler. And she done this before. She got in a race against Curlin, Cheek Kilpatrick, and Martha Scott, and they split the vote. I don't see her winning, but if it comes down to Adam being thrown off the ballot and you got Mary Waters sitting up there, Shree is going to have to campaign, because then you're going to have folks falling in line behind Mary saying, hey, you know what? Listen, I'd rather have her than have him. Regardless,
I want to ask kind of just a broad question, and you can pick any type of like incumbent candidate. You could pick someone on the state legislative level. You can pick someone on the congressional level. I mean, which incumbent right now do you think Detroit voters are most frustrated with?
I mean, between Biden and Shree, I think those are I hear a lot of frustrations to Adolph's point about, you know, just the level of resources that are needed to help the communities here, you know, particularly in Detroit. And there's a frustration that they're not really seeing much out of their congressmen. And I think there's a lot of similar concerns about Biden that are not, you know, specifically related to the Israel-Hamas conflict. That's certainly a dynamic in other parts of Wayne County and the state. But I just think people are feeling really pressed, you know, economically, and, you know, just not really better off than they were 4 years ago. And it's going to be interesting, I think, to see how the Biden campaign addresses that. He's going to be in Detroit at the NAACP's annual Fight for Freedom dinner. Vice President Kamala Harris is in Detroit today to talk about investments in electric vehicle manufacturing. But I've yet to really hear a strong message for kind of the average Detroit, like, Black voter. A lot of what they focus on the campaign so far in their visits to the Detroit area are, you know, things like union support and investments in small businesses and the impact of pandemic aid, which has, you know, certainly been significant here in the city. We've heard Mayor Duggan talk about kind of the transformative impact of ARPA money pushing the city forward, you know, a decade in his mind. But I don't know that that's really connecting with people. Mr. Mongo, you probably have a better sense of that than I do.
Well, listen, the days of Coleman Young delivering hundreds of thousands of votes or whatever, and you had ministers like the late Charles Adams, those kind of people that could deliver, they're no longer here. And the Democrats don't have anyone on the national level that can come into a city like Detroit or Pittsburgh or Cleveland or Philly and say, you know what, get them riled up, get them excited. I think the only person that can do that, and he's going to have a hard time, is that former President Obama. And I don't see him coming in campaigning like that. He's pretty much been on the sideline. The president, grandpa, as I call President Biden, just not the person to come into a city like Detroit and get these young folks out to vote. People are frustrated. They don't want to vote for either party. So who they have left? Robert Kennedy, he's going to get some votes. By name recognition, he's going to get some votes. But a lot of folks are going to stay at home. The Michigan Democratic Party, they've been invisible inside southeastern Michigan. I don't know what they've been doing, and I'm sure they'll tell me we've been working the ground, but I don't see it.
Why do you guys believe that Rashida Tlaib did not end up getting a viable primary opponent?
She got, $5 million in a war chest? She's in a safe district because she has a coalition. I don't support Rashida Tlaib. She did the same thing that Sri did to get elected. Had 7 or 8 opponents, and she won barely, but she's there. And now she moved over into a new district. She got folks that's going to support her through hell and back. She has a large number of Black support. She done built up a coalition, whether you agree with it or not. She knows how to campaign. She knocks on the doors, and she knows how to throw all the BS to voters. To say, oh, I'm doing this and I'm doing that. When she was in the 13th district, her agenda was Gaza from day one. It wasn't 13th district. She went right over there and antagonized the Israeli government. And here, she's been doing it ever since. She's strong.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think between her fundraising, between the relationship she's built in the district, she just seems very tough to beat on paper. And while she's frustrated, the Democratic Party in Wayne County, I think folks know that that would be a pretty uphill battle. She has a reputation of being really responsive to issues in the district as well, from what I understand. She's really talked a lot about environmental pollution and, you know, cracking down on industry that's harming communities has been kind of an issue that I hear talk about a lot as well. So, yeah, I mean, I just think it's tough when she's got that kind of money backing, and I don't know who it would be, you know, who is that person within the district that'd be able to rise up.
Nobody.
Especially when Tlaib's and she's a national fundraiser too. I mean, the dynamics within Southeast Michigan, she's brought a lot of attention nationally, obviously, to her statements on Hamas and the Gaza war, but I think it's overall benefited her. I don't think that's really been a negative for her campaign.
But has that blocked her? While she's safe in that seat, I don't see her going anyplace else. She basically, she's cemented herself right there in that district right there. If she had any aspirations of joining an administration or running for the Senate, good luck with that.
I'm really curious how the U.S. Senate candidate's been doing when it comes to the city of Detroit. Of course, we had television actor Hill Harper, who resides in the city's Boston Edison district. There's a bit of fire around his campaign when it initially launched during the summertime of 2023. That seems to have died down a little bit. And of course, you have Alyssa Slotkin. She's the perceived front runner of that U.S. Senate primary. And ahead of launching of her campaign in 2023, she said she wanted to see how she performed outside of her Lansing area, Northern Oakland County district, ahead of entering the race, particularly in areas like Metro Detroit and Detroit. So overall, main question, how have those two been performing?
Well, people don't know who Alyssa Slotkin is unless you just follow politics. And Hill Harper, he has some support, but you are absolutely right. He has fell off the radar in the last 3 or 4 months. He had had some issues with his campaign finance report, you know, saying that he didn't have any money and he got millions of dollars, et cetera. Obviously, he's not going to spend his own money. And Slotkin, with all the money, with all the fanfare, you would think that this would be a piece of cake. And it's not a piece of cake. Mike Rogers is nobody to play with or sleep on. It's going to be a close race. And if Slotkin gets the nomination, she's going to have to come into Detroit and she's going to have to get some of those folks that supported Hill Harper, going to have to bring them to the table. So it has to be a unity ticket, so to speak. And right now, people are split.
Why don't they know who she is?
Listen, you know what? She represented another district. People barely know who their own congressperson is. They don't even know who the state rep is. That's how frustrated folks are, you know. Anytime you can only get 10 or 15% of the people to go out and vote, a few people decide all the elections. No, they don't know who she is. Where's her campaign office at? If she opened it up, where? East side, west side? I don't know. No, she's not visible, not the way she should be. And she has a lot of money. You just can't. That old type of campaign of let's go and get about five ministers and they're going to deliver the vote. Those days are over with. They can't deliver the vote. The only people that can deliver the vote is an organized campaign that really go in and knock on doors and talk to those folks that they might be registered, but they haven't voted in the last 2 or 3 elections. And that you talk about the issues that they're looking at, the schools or the there's no supermarkets in the neighborhoods or the gas stations. You can't even stop and get gas. Those are the type of candidates that people are looking at. And they're frustrated that this is a Democratic city and the Democratic Party just take it for granted that you got nowhere to go. I don't think so. I've talked to a lot of young folks that said, well, either I don't vote or I'm voting for Trump. So that's the Democrat problem right there. And that's the list of Slotkin problem.
I got just one more question for both of you. What was your overall reaction to the newly drawn state house maps that the federal court signed off on?
And you know what? Democrats threw the Detroit voters under the bus to take to get in control of the House and the Senate. It wasn't a good look because you got people that lived in Warren representing people that lived in Highland Park. And that means folks didn't even have to come into the city to campaign to win. So they had to change. And some people, community people, are mad at Jocelyn Benson for opposing it, saying, leave it alone. Let's go with what we got. So if she thinks that she can just come back, if she's running for higher office, where I hear that she wants to be the governor, et cetera, she's going to have to make amends on her stance. They needed to change. You don't throw your most loyal base and your biggest supporters under the bus like they did. You had Democrat out of Detroit incumbent running against another incumbent out of Royal Oak in the state Senate race. It didn't make any sense how they drew up those boundaries.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard some optimism from folks that challenged the maps, saying that these new maps are an improvement, probably didn't go as far as they would like to ensure that, you know, seats have high percentages of Black voters. But I think it's really, it's going to be really interesting to see how this kind of evolving dynamic between Detroit Democrats and Democrats in the suburbs, how they compete, these kind of geographic boundaries that come into play when, you know, Detroit candidates have to go into the suburbs to campaign and vice versa. Do they understand the issues? Are they even welcomed? You know, there were some claims during the process that it was actually somewhat dangerous for election, for campaign staff to go into the suburbs, that they were kind of targeted or felt to be unwelcome in some of these kind of suburban neighborhoods. And I think there's a real kind of tension between Black Detroit candidates who feel like, you know, really the suburbs should stay out of this area. They don't understand the issues here, and you can't really get true representation without somebody that's from the community.
Well, you know, the issues in Birmingham and in Detroit on the west side is different. Right. Well, the issues in Birmingham and Royal Oak or Royal Oak Township are different. So you got, you know, so you got to be real careful trying to throw. Holland Park got different kind of issues than Warren has. And you got a guy getting elected state rep in Warren, and Holland Park is part of his district. Giving Holland Park, forgiving their water debt, might not play good with those folks that elected him from the majority of the voters out of the city of Warren. So it's like merging two high schools, and you got rival gangs, and that happens in the city of Detroit. And you put them all in one school without thinking, what are you going to have? You're going to have chaos from day one. So they had to do something. And hopefully with this Senate redistricting, they get it right. But I wouldn't bet on it.
So we are out of time, but everybody, that is Adolph Mongo, a Detroit podcaster and political commentator. Additionally, journalist Malachi Barrett, a Detroit local government and community issues reporter for Bridge Detroit. Thank you, both of you, for taking the time out of your day to join us on the MERS Monday podcast. Joining us for our middle segment of the MERS Monday podcast is Majority Floor Leader Abraham Ayash of the Michigan House of Representatives. He is a Democrat representing the present-day 9th State House District, consisting of the city of Hamtramck and adjacent communities in Detroit. Before initially arriving in Lansing as a House legislator in 2021, Representative Ayash served as executive director of the Yemeni American Merchants Association in 2020 and was a statewide training and political leadership director for Michigan United, the statewide coalition addressing issues related to immigration, environment, and mass incarceration. Representative Ayash made Michigan political headlines near the end of April when he withdrew his reelection bid in the recently redrawn 7th State House District, still consisting of the communities he represents in Hamtramck and bits of Detroit. Hello, Representative Ayash. How are you doing this morning?
Great. Thank you for having me.
So let's just dive right into the subject that we're all here for today. Why did you decide to withdraw your reelection efforts for this year?
You know, term limit reform has really shifted the way we have an opportunity to serve in the legislature. I know in many years past, there's this idea that if you really wanted to be in the House, all you got to do is wait 6 years until there's an open seat and so on and so forth. You know, that has clearly shifted. And I'm 30 years old and there are opportunities for me to do a lot of great things. And I just want to be able to maximize the output that I would have in any work that I do. And I feel like there are other opportunities to make that happen.
Now, Representative, you are the House Majority Floor Leader, so that's not a small title by any stretch. One could argue that if you stayed in the House and were able to keep majority, you would have an oversized role in making policy in that position. So why not stay there as opposed to being in a Senate caucus where you may not have the same opportunity?
Yeah, so you know it's been an incredible honor to serve as the Majority Floor Leader. The Speaker and I have built a great dynamic, and you know that's probably the one thing that I'm gonna miss the most is just being able to do that role. But I think the question for me became: is there a way to continue to maximize impact in other ways? And the verdict is still out on guess what is going to happen. But I feel like there could be opportunities to do more work in other spaces. And when that opportunity comes, certainly I'm excited to take it on. We still have work to do for the rest of this term. So it's not like we're checking out completely. You know, we have 8 more months to pass a budget, to continue to pass legislation and maintain and hopefully expand the majority so that we can keep doing good work on behalf of the state of Michigan.
Just if I could follow up a second here, Representative, I've heard it said that the reason you were looking at the Senate is you were concerned about your chances of being elected floor leader next term if you were to be reelected and the Democrats were able to take majority. Is there any truth to that rumor?
No, absolutely not. You know, this decision was made well before there's even any rumblings about anyone possibly interested in that role. And I will say, if the election were to happen today for floor leader and I was on the ballot, I have no doubt that a majority of my colleagues would vote for me to stay in that role. And as the speaker has always said, there is value in continuity of leadership, and there's value in incumbency of leadership. So I have full confidence that had I stayed for another term, that my colleagues would have honored me with that role again. But I will say we will have a great successor in my post, and I'm looking forward to supporting them as the time goes on.
Is there someone you're looking at specifically or have picked out yet that you believe would be best suited to take your spot?
Yeah. So, you know, I've had extensive conversations with some colleagues that have expressed interest in this role. And, you know, when the time comes, I'll be making that known who I'll be supporting in that capacity.
As someone who is a progressive voice in the state legislature right now, what has been the most challenging thing about being the House Majority Floor Leader with the given dynamics of the Democratic trifecta?
I think it, regardless of what your political leanings are within the Democratic Party, it's just being able to recognize that you need 56 votes to move the ball down the field. And not everyone's going to have the same perspective as you. So just managing that expectation and recognizing that there are a lot of important things that have to happen. But as I always say, government moves like honey, but it's not as sweet. There's a lot of things that we need to get done. There are a lot of things that I wish we got done, but there's also the realities of the political dynamics in the state, the political dynamics nationally, and then managing that with stakeholders, managing that with interest groups, and obviously managing it with constituencies, which is the baseline and most important aspect of the work. All of those things make that job a little bit more difficult in terms of prioritizing what is it that we need to do. But we're incredibly proud of the work that we've done in the first 16 or 18 months or so in this work.
What are your thoughts on the state's present day state of corporate incentives? For example, let's talk about the SOAR fund. I mean, your colleagues are working on a budget right now where essentially $500 million was already committed to the SOAR fund in the beginning of last year. What are your thoughts on the way that corporate incentives have evolved in our state?
You know, this is definitely not something that I feel is the best way for us to maximize investment in our state of Michigan, as well as ensuring people want to move here. There are other ways that we can incentivize communities, incentivize companies to invest in Michigan. So we have seen clearly that the current SOAR model may not be the best approach for us to attract jobs and people in the state of Michigan. And the best way to do it is if you invest in human capital. Companies are not looking for how much money you're going to throw at them, but they want to know, is there an educated workforce? Is there opportunities for them to send their kids to good schools and childcare if they need it? Is there access to reliable transportation? Is there a good housing stock? Those are the things that employers need to make sure their employees have. And I think we have a chance to invest more in those priorities rather than simply saying, here's a big check, create jobs, and we'll give it to you. And you know, as we've seen, unfortunately, even the jobs that are being created are not high paying or high wage jobs. So then the question becomes, if someone cannot raise a family or even provide for themselves and a partner, are we actually making the best, most sound investment? And I think the verdict is still out, but it's leaning clearly that there are other opportunities and ways for us to address this issue.
So then, you know, with all that in mind, how do you feel about the Senate's SOAR proposal that allocated 50% of funding towards community development. Do you think that's something that could potentially see support from people like yourself in the House?
I've certainly a step in the right direction, prioritizing those needs of human capital and investing in that is far more of a strategic move for our state to attract young families, to attract young people to lay their roots in Michigan. So I do think that's a great first step, but I think we have to have a deeper conversation of what are we trying to do? And it's a difficult balance because if we say, well, we're not going to give incentives, other states are going to offer the same, and then those jobs go there. But as a state, the question we have to ask ourselves is what type of industries would we want in the state of Michigan? And are those industries going to provide some of those jobs and that you can raise a family with that income? If the answer is, well, these jobs are not going to be able to do that, then we have to go back to the drawing board and figure something out.
Representative, over the weekend, we had protests disrupt the commencement ceremonies at the University of Michigan. I wanted to get your thoughts on the number of anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian protests that we're seeing across the country.
Well, you know, Kyle, I've actually been through several of those protests at the University of Michigan and several schools in other states, including Stanford. What I will tell you is there's definitely a hyperbolic, exaggerated assessment of what is going on these college campuses. The vast majority of these protests and these protesters have been incredibly peaceful. And the message is clear. We are anti-war. That has killed over 30,000 people. Most have been innocent men, women, and children. Over 10,000 children have been massacred in this process. Folks want to see pro-peace. We want this country to lead with peace. And we have not seen that, unfortunately, where the foreign policy of the United States has not prioritized protecting innocent men, women, and children, particularly in the Gaza Strip. And we have not seen a shift in policy despite all the pushback from people across the world. An overwhelming majority of Americans, Democrats or Republicans, support a ceasefire and an end to the violence. We have not seen that happen. So we are seeing college students all across the country raising their voices and leveraging their power to say that we demand that our universities no longer aid and abet anything that is tantamount to a genocide and apartheid, and that we need to make sure that our country leads with that moral clarity that we claim that we have.
And if I could follow up on this, I was reading Mitch Albom this morning in the Detroit Free Press, and he suggested these protests are aiming toward getting rid of the state of Israel. Is that what you're seeing in these protests?
No. And I think any assessment is like that is quite frankly just silly and disingenuous. These are young people that are saying we want our country to lead with peace. We want to see an end to the investment of supporting a war. And we want to make sure that we are going to be arbiters of human rights and justice. And that is clearly not happening when you have over 30,000 people that have been murdered, more than half being women and children. So the question has to be, what can we do as a nation to ensure that we are not going to continue that carnage that we are seeing in the death and the destruction? And the best way to do that is to, in fact, call for a ceasefire, put an end to the violence, and simply just set a standard that these are the ways in which we expect our allies, these are the ways in which we expect any entity, any nation state rather, that is getting U.S. support, that they follow certain tenets of human rights and American principles and values.
When you personally go to these demonstrations, what type of role do you play? Are you like a sort of advisor? Are you just a peer? What type of role do you play as you go into these spaces?
I just show up and I'm not really there to sort of grab attention. I just wanted to watch and really get a sense of what is going on, because you see some of these clips and you've heard some of these folks tweet. It's like, let's get an understanding of what's really happening. So yeah, I just attended. I sat through some of the programs. There were some musical performances during one. There were some speeches in other places, and just folks are just there making their presence known and setting that the tone of we are going to be here until things change. And it really was peaceful. It was organized. This is a very impressive thing that a lot of these young folks have been able to put together.
So what do you personally do, though, if you come across a action or symbolism or rhetoric that is very hateful or offensive to other individuals on campus? Do you tell them, do you maybe take on a role as an advisor to say, hey, maybe we shouldn't be doing this. Let's say something else. Let's do something else. How do you kind of navigate that when you come across something that is deemed as hateful rhetoric?
So, you know, there was nothing that I saw in all three of those campuses I had visited that was seen as explicitly offensive or Islamophobic or anti-Semitic. But certainly there is space to condemn and call out anything that distracts from the main message. And the main message was, we are a pro-peace anti-war movement, and we expect our university leaders, as well as our government, to stand by those principles. And that was the message that I saw resonated all across those campuses. And it was a very diverse coalition of people that were speaking out, faculty and students, that leaned into that message that we do not want to see any innocent man, woman, and child murdered by any entity, certainly not by the United States support. And we do believe there's a pathway to peace. And that was the message that I saw all across those campuses.
Representative, who do you plan on voting for president?
I have one priority this November, and it's Joe Tate, making sure that we keep the gavel, we continue to expand and build on our majority so that we can keep doing all the great things that we still want to do and really take pride in the stuff that we've already accomplished. So I'm focused on electing Democrats down ballot, ensuring that we are maintaining the majority in the House, hopefully growing it, and coming back with a Democratic trifecta once again in 2025.
You had me in the first half with Joe there. But speaking of Speaker Tate, I know that the budget has been, you know, a huge focus for Democrats this term, and especially in the last few months. But, you know, do you think there's another piece of policy outside of the budget that you're really focused on and is something that you believe can also get across the finish line? If you had to pick one, what would it be?
Ah, that's tough. Honestly, there's a lot of things that we need to get done. I think the question is, what's the capacity going to look like after we get the budget done to be able to move some of those priorities? So this idea that we're completely finished with what we want to accomplish with our policies just simply is not true. I think the priority has to be that folks are going to start looking towards an election cycle. And we got to make sure that we're going to be on the ground and talking to voters across the state, because we do have a top of the ticket on both sides that is very distracting. And I think people have set emotions and expectations of what they have in terms of President Trump and President Biden. So the question is, what will we do as House Democrats to remind people of all the incredible work we've done, putting money back in people's pockets through the repeal of the retirement tax and the earned income tax credit, reinstating and growing that historic legislation around protecting people's rights, protecting our planet, and expanding opportunities for people. These are all the things that we can continue to push on. And we have an obligation to get that budget done, and we will. And then we will assess what we can get done before November 5th.
And Representative, to that point, though, I wanted to see if you've heard the conversations about members of your caucus trying to get a solution to auto no-fault reform done before the budget. And are you on board with that?
Look, I've made no qualms about the fact that the 2019 fix was a failure. It did not accomplish the goals that was laid out. So there's definitely an opportunity for us to address the issue. I think the question that folks are trying to manage right now is, what can we do to move that issue, and what exactly is the best way to address the problem? So it's definitely an issue that is a priority, you know, making sure that we are reducing costs. You know, my insurance is not cheap. I'm paying over $3,500 a year for my rates. So I did not see many savings there, which I know a lot of folks are like thinking, what the heck? But I mean, that's really what people are paying in my communities. So we really got to go back to the drawing board and figure out, how can we actually reduce costs for people? How can we make sure that insurance is set almost exclusively, or the main priority has to be around your driving record and not other factors like territory, like credit report, and things of that nature? That's what we have to try to figure out. And then addressing the care component is absolutely critical to make sure that people are getting that care that they deserve and they're entitled to.
Okay, so obviously we still have 7 months left of 2024, so you're not done yet in the House by any means. But when you think about it, though, as you look at your final 7 months as a state House member, what would you say is your top dream priority that you would love to see reach the finish line if you had to pick one golden goose of them all?
Growing and maintaining the majority.
Is it a golden goose or a golden egg?
You know, I'm not sure. You can call it a Michigander or a Michiganian. As long as it's 57 or 56, I'm happy.
Everybody, that is House Majority Floor Leader Abraham Ayash, a Democrat from Hamtramck. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the MERS Monday podcast. Can you feel the summer breeze? Does it do to you what it does to me? Oh, feel the summer breeze. Joining us for our final segment of the MERS Monday podcast is State Senator Thomas Albert, a Kent County Republican representing Michigan's 18th Senate District, covering portions of West and Southwest Michigan. The senator has previously served as a House Appropriations Committee Chair and was formerly an investor for the State of Michigan Retirement Systems. Currently, amid today's Democratic-led legislature in Lansing, Senator Albert serves on the Senate Appropriations Committee and as the Minority Vice Chair of the Senate Labor Committee, and as the Minority Vice Chair of the General Government and Universities and Community Colleges Appropriation Subcommittees. Hello, Senator. How are you doing today?
Samantha, thanks for having me on. You missed probably my favorite job, being a Marine. So seems like a while ago.
I apologize. Yes. So when were you in the Marines?
After college. So I did that for a few years. So that was 2007 to 2010. I was in the reserves for a little bit too when I was going to business school.
To kind of dive right into this conversation, you have been very transparent about some of your concerns throughout this budget making process. What are kind of some of your top three biggest concerns now that we are in the thick of budget making season here in Lansing?
It's probably worth noting before I get to the top ones, just kind of noting the different environment that we're in. A few years ago when I was appropriations chair, it felt like every time I would blink, we'd have another couple hundred million dollars out of some different pot that we'd have to, you know, try to find a way to use wisely or save. That environment's over. We're at the point now, if you look over the last few, we get monthly revenue numbers. They kind of compare what the estimates were versus the actual. And they're coming in slightly under. It's not like I wouldn't say there's a huge trend like, you know, the earth's shattering, but it's cooled. It's cooled and we're living more in a normal environment. So with that kind of context in mind, what we did last year was we bloated the size and scale of government. We had over 700 full-time equivalent positions that were added, lots of types of new programs, lots of increases to programs we already have. Oh, well, now we're in a situation where we have to try to find money to keep that all afloat. So with that in mind, the rate of the $670 million for the pension fund for the schools is probably my number one issue. That can get complicated pretty quick, but it's actually pretty simple to think about. The question at hand is there one floor for the floor funding requirement or are there two floors? I wrote the law in 2018. It's pretty clear to me. The statute's, you know, it's pretty clear. There's one floor.
One thing that has been interesting for me to learn, and we had the K-12 Alliance on the podcast last week, is that school districts have their own contribution obligations to the MIPSERS fund. And essentially, they don't get to see those contribution obligations removed until OPEB reaches 140%. And that makes me ask, do you think anyone realized that when they put forward this initial proposal?
No, and that's a whole different discussion, and I think that's a fair one. If we've paid off the debt for that portion, because they are still paying debt for the pension and they are still paying normal cost. The employee contribution, a great conversation. It's outside of the scope of what the governor's proposing here, so I just think it's a totally different circumstances. So it's a different conversation. I mean, what we have here is we have over $30 billion of debt. And what's that actually mean right now? What's it mean when you have that much debt? I took the numbers. I added up all of the MIPSERS contributions. That's the retirement system for the schools. Added all that up for last year and divided it by the amount of state restricted school revenue we have. How much money do we raise in Michigan for schools? We spent 32 cents on the dollar into the retirement system. That is substantial. And if we take our foot off the gas pedal now, it's just going to get worse. Those interest costs are just going to continue to rise. We're going to be taking more money out of the classroom, and we're going to be putting pensioners' benefits at risk. And it's just a very imprudent decision. So I'd say that's number one. Number two, there's a proposal to move a lot of state employees into the state troopers' pension. I have a lot of issues with that. I put forth a better proposal to enhance their defined contribution rate. I do think there's a good argument that what they're currently getting now is not enough to save for retirement based on what their wages are. So I think there's some room there to have a good conversation and come out with a better solution. So I think what I propose with a better defined contribution plan that's based on the years you work will help with recruitment and retention and you know, helping them prepare for retirement. So
that's intended toward conservation officers and corrections officers, correct?
There's a handful. There's four different budgets that would impact. The number one, I guess the largest group of employees that would impact is corrections officers. You know, we have a good deal of prisons throughout the state, so it'd be all the corrections officers within those. But conservations as well, it applies to them. There's just not as many. So yeah, that's who that group is that would apply to. The third one that goes into, this is more of a, it's not in the budget. You won't see a line item for it, but it's the income tax increase, the income tax rate increase back to 4.25. The fact that the administration feels like we have to do that in order to balance our books reflects how much spending we have increased over the last year. So I think those are my top three, the MIPSRS raid, reopening the pension back up for certain state employees, and the increasing the income tax rate.
Now, with the income tax rate return being the restoration to that 4.25% after being 4.05% for the recently concluded tax year, you've had courts essentially begin rejecting the idea that this is a long-term permanent tax reduction. What more can happen on that front if you already aren't seeing success in the courts?
If it's true, if the courts find that the language wasn't written well enough and it was ambiguous enough that we could have this be a temporary reduction and increase it back from 4.05 to 4.25, doesn't mean there's nothing holding us back from the legislature from codifying the 4.05. I mean, it was the legislative intent clearly when it was written. Everybody who was involved with it, the governor's come out and said that that's the way it was meant to be. I've heard him talk about it when I was in the House about how we have lowered the income tax rate, and he talked about that trigger. So I know from years from experience that was what it was meant. So I guess my point is, yeah, we don't have to let the courts decide this. We could change it right now if we wanted.
Now, I also want to poke your mind on the Strategic Outreach and Attraction Reserve Fund, Michigan's corporate incentive pot of money. So you were the House Appropriations Chair in December 2021 when that fund was originally created for corporate incentives. My question for you is, how did you originally imagine the fund would operate?
That's a great question. I had a very unique position at that time. I wasn't a huge fan of the SOAR plan. I wasn't a huge fan of the economic development strategy, but I kind of took the position of, look, other states are doing this. It stinks, but if we're going to be competitive, we're going to have to try and find a way to do this in a prudent manner. So I did help, you know, with the SOAR fund. The idea, at least what I tried to do, was put some guardrails on, make sure we have some legislative oversight, make sure we try to do this so MEDC just can't go out and make big deals and spend all our money without there really being any type of good due diligence. You have to remember, I worked at the state pension fund as an investor. So, I mean, this is my wheelhouse, looking at deals. The problem with governments making these types of investments is they don't know when to walk away. When you're doing investing, you have to be comfortable saying no, because once a deal becomes a loser, you can't be so invested in it. You can't be so tied up in it that you just can't walk away. So that's what's happening in Michigan. And I've had a big change of philosophy when it comes to economic development. I just think we got to get out of it. I proposed the a package to repeal the SOAR fund that we have, this whole incentive package. We have to grow our economy from the ground up. We have to have a better tax policy, better tax rates than our competitors, both other states and other nations. We have to have a better regulatory policy. We have to have better talent. We have to have an environment where people want to grow. That's why doing things like repealing our right to work law was a disaster, because it is not welcoming for growth. I mean, who's going to want to move here? Who's going to want to have roots here? who's going to want to invest more in their company here. So I guess for me personally, I've had a big change of heart. I think if we would have taken all the money we put into SOAR, all those billions of dollars, and we would have used it to let people keep their own money, lower tax rates, we would have seen more growth. We would have seen people invest more in their own business, create more jobs. We would have seen people invest more in their local communities. We would have given entrepreneurs more of an opportunity to come up with some type of new gadget or new service that would have, you know, helped create something better. So I think we need to take a totally different approach to economic development.
When you think about the SOAR Fund, and when you were House Appropriations Chair, that was designed with, what, more than $1 billion from the general fund, that initial appropriation. Did you think that the state would only spend that amount of money and not continue to make investments and new appropriations into the fund?
No, I mean, I saw there would be a potential for continuing to put money into it. And I knew that would happen. I mean, look, when I was a Probst chair, we approved two different deals. There was the Ford deal for like $100 million. And you know, I looked at that deal as close as I could for the information I had. And they were putting in like almost 10 times the amount of capital that the state was. If you go back and look at the committee, like I asked them tons of questions about how many jobs is it going to create for how long. Same thing with the GM deal. I supported that. That was like $666 million, I believe. Lots of different investments, you know, throughout the state. I asked a lot of questions. I tried to do a lot of due diligence, but it's gone off the rails so bad. I mean, Marshall is in my district. The amount of incentives that was given, that might be the case study of the worst economic incentive ever given in the United States in our entire history. I'd challenge anyone to find anyone worse than that. I mean, originally, if you added up all the incentives, we were looking at like $690,000 per job, I believe. And then in a totally mind-blowing fashion, they were able to reduce their investment by about half, Ford was. How did we not have any type of contractual structure in place that would prevent them from doing so? And even if they did, that we couldn't walk back our investment as well. I mean, we ended up total losers on that.
And with Marshall being in your district, I mean, how many of your constituents do you think actually liked that Ford project?
It's so split. You have people who really want it. They see great opportunity for the community, long-term growth. And you have people who have had their lives turned upside down, felt like they had to sell their property because everybody else around them did. And it's been very divisive. And to have something that divisive happen for something that's not that good of an investment is really bad. And we haven't even gotten into the Goshen one. That one on its face has a lot of problems with investing straight into a Chinese company. There's a lot of issues with that.
I was also curious about, why do you think Senate Republicans don't like Senate Democrats' 360 program for basically redesigning the SOAR fund so that half of appropriations are going toward a community investment that improves quality of life? That seems like a transformation of this fund. So I'm a little bit curious about why it's so polarizing.
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. So I'm happy to clarify that. That's just centralized planning from a different perspective. Instead of doing it directly with giving corporate handouts, it's thinking that we in Lansing know how to develop the local communities is better than they do. That's a bit of an oversimplification, but when you're looking at it through this lens here of how should we do economic development, it's just what's Lansing going to decide that's best? And that just doesn't work. It doesn't work. You have to let things grow from the ground up organically if it's going to work. If you look at our history of the United States, free enterprise and free markets is what has unleashed a historic amount of innovation and prosperity. And I think we just need to get back to the basics. I think we're trying to be too clever with ways that we can be so smart in Lansing and grow our communities. Now, let's just let people keep their money. Let's let them be efficient with their money. Let's them do what's best for their community. I think that's where we got to go.
What do you think is an economic development or budget proposal that a Republican might have in Lansing right now that is most realistically achievable amid a Democratic trifecta?
Honestly, it's not going to be doubling down on corporate welfare. It's just not. It's just not realistic. It's not going to be putting more money into the SOAR fund. If you're going to do something, it would have to be putting more guardrails on SOAR. I saw the House put out some stuff there. That was fine. I see what they're doing, and it's better than the status quo. I mean, putting audits on there, things of that nature. Personally, you want to get my attention? Let's lower taxes. I mean, there's different ways you can do that. It doesn't have to be just the income tax rate. I mean, the city of Detroit has both a city income tax rate and a corporate income tax rate. and their property taxes are about 90 mils, roughly. They tax their people into poverty. Unfortunately, I shouldn't say it that way. The one thing about the city of Detroit is everybody is connected to it. If Detroit does poorly, the rest of the state's going to do poorly. So maybe we just look at the city of Detroit and see if there's something we can do there to unleash growth and have it kind of spread throughout the state.
Yeah, but I mean, my question was about Republicans, though. I mean, what are some Republican proposals that you think can get done, even with Democrats holding the gavel?
What I was saying was lowering income tax rates. If you want to get Republicans on board, I think that's the easiest way to do it. There's not going to be a centralized planning mechanism where we're going to get involved in or we're going to be happy with. Or you're going to get six Republicans for IE on. They're going to have to change focus. And even the Democrats are split on this. The Democrats don't even really want to do SOAR in its current form anymore. So, I think looking at our tax structure is probably the best way to go.
I know that you do have a bill that deals with restoring right to work after it was repealed last year. Why did you decide to introduce that?
I'd like to send a signal to people throughout Michigan and throughout the rest of the country that that was not a prudent repeal that we did. We're going to get it back in place. We're going to give people freedom. Myself, personally, I'm not anti-union. Unions are fine. I think they serve a purpose. If someone wants to join one, great. I'm glad they do. And then that way they can help improve the business that they work at, make sure they have a good work environment. Nobody should be compelled to be part of one. I heard a story once about somebody who voted for right to work. They were in their community at a gym and somebody came up to them. They could tell this person was a construction worker. And they thought, oh boy, they're going to be this. I don't know how this is going to go. And the person said, you know, I got to thank you for voting for putting our right to work law in place, because for years I couldn't get my union to listen to me. And now they're responding when I go up and talk to them. So this is an issue of fairness, and this is an issue of liberty and freedom. We should not be compelling people to associate and spending their hard-earned dollars on something that they don't want to be part of.
Based off of conversations you're hearing, are we starting to see the effects of the right to work repeal after it became effective earlier this year in February?
No, I haven't. Yeah, I think it's way too early to tell. And a lot of those conversations aren't going to be out in the public. If somebody is thinking of expanding their business and they move to Indiana, you know, they might not close up shop and move to Indiana. They might just, when they expand, they put a new building in somewhere else. So this is going to be a really decentralized, it's going to be really decentralized when we think about how this growth happens and how the effects are going to be seen. It's not going to be all big three auto companies closing all of their factories at once and leaving. It'll be very gradual.
What are your thoughts on some of the tax credit proposals that are circulating right now?
I'm not a huge fan of tax credits. I would rather just have a lower income tax rate for everybody. I think there's less room for manipulation. It's easier to understand, and it's more fairly applied to all residents.
But do you think, it seems though that often that, at least from a reporter perspective, that when there's talk about tax credits, they seem to be kind of wrapped up in a ribbon of bipartisan opportunity, ? Do you think they're becoming more polarizing, or do you think that's just a you thing?
I don't think it's just a me thing. That's something Snyder was very adamant about when he was a governor. He got rid of a lot of tax credits and simplified our tax code. I think one great example to juxtapose was when we increased the earned income tax credit. I was very open to the earned income tax credit. I see the merits of it. And there is evidence to show that it will help move people out of poverty. So I really dug into that to see, hey, is this something I can get behind? And there's a couple of flaws with it. The first one is that the amount of, I don't want to say fraud, but misuse. A lot of people don't understand if they're part of the, if they actually qualify. So you saw like 20-25% of people were later found to not be eligible. That's a big problem. The other is that although it might lift people out of poverty, there's no evidence that it actually improves people entering into the workforce. So it doesn't move the needle on actually working. So I proposed an alternative solution, and that was increasing our standard deduction. So that way, the first $10,000 or $15,000 that someone earned would be tax-free. And that way it's proportionally helping those with less means more, which is good. And it's not open to any type of manipulation at all, because it's just your first amount of income that you'd have in the door. So that's an example of, like, I think the tax credit had some good merits. I understand the intentions behind it, but I think there's a heck of a lot better way of doing it, just increasing the standard deduction.
And we are over time, but can I just ask you one final question? Is there anything that you're seeing, though, right now in the current budget making process that you do like?
I think that the revenue sharing proposal that was in the Senate has a lot of promise. I think there was a lot of work that went into that. I was glad to see my colleague, Senator Cherry, and his efforts. Not saying it's perfect yet, but it looks pretty good out the gate.
No, well, everybody, that is State Senator Thomas Albert, a Kent County Republican representing Michigan's 18th Senate District. Thank you for joining us on the MERS Monday podcast.
Appreciate it, Samantha.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Oh, so I want to clarify to our listeners that for my interview with Senator Albert, I did not have my microphone. So I apologize if the sound was a little bit different than what it's usually been like, as I was depending on my laptop microphone. But now it is time to thank our numerous guests who spoke with us this week. Thank you so much to Bridge Detroit journalist Malachi Barrett and Detroit political commentator Adolph Mong, who spoke with us this morning. Additionally, thank you to State House Majority Floor Leader Abraham Ayash, a Hamtramck Democrat, for joining us this morning as well. Also, thank you so much to State Senator Thomas Albert, a Kent County Republican serving Michigan's 18th State Senate District, for joining me on the show Friday morning, May 3rd. Last but not least, I would love to express my substantial gratitude to the MERS team, especially editor Kyle Malin and House reporter Danielle James, who joined me on today's episode and assisted me with setting it up. Furthermore, thank you so much to Mark Bayshore of Mark Bayshore Audio out in Okemos, which is responsible for putting this audio together. Until next time, I am your host, Samantha Schreiber.